Welcome to another edition of Revealing the Truth with Brandon Wells. One of the things that I've always been really fascinated by is different types of belief systems and culture and society and all sorts of other things that go along with that, including different types of religions and things of that nature. And I find it deeply fascinating. You know, how could you not? And, you know, just looking at the differences and the similarities. One of the things that I've actually noticed in my years of researching things is that there are a lot of, shall we say, almost identical, I mean, the word similar doesn't necessarily quite cut it sometimes, but almost identical stories to certain, you know, people, whether it's in the Bible, whether it's in the Quran, the Torah, or just way, 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 way back before all that. And I always found it really interesting when you start to kind of like just sit back and, you know, take it all in. Don't, you know, I know a lot of people when they're doing this, and especially if they're already, you know, kind of growing up in a certain belief system, they tend to put their own religious spin on it. And I find that really kind of destructive as far as like trying to learn the material to be able to compare and contrast and everything. So that being said, there's a lot of stories that came out of ancient Egypt. And one of the people that's in ancient Egypt was a guy named Thoth. And amongst the Egyptian gods, none other than was more multifaceted than him. And originally the god of Thoth was is considered to be the god of the moon. But he's also the god of writing, particularly Egyptian hieroglyphics and science and magic and judgment, among other things. And his parentage and origins are, for a lot of ways, very deeply speculative. In other words, you're going to hear like a lot of different variations of where he, or how rather, he derived of being who he became. So some of them are contradictory, but a lot of them out there, I mean, can be said for a lot of them if you really want to, you know, dive deep into them and everything. Now, I hate the word myth, so I will do my best to not use the word myth or legend. I don't like those words because I think it kind of belittles, you know, what I'm about to tell you. All right, so the stories that are concerning Thoth and his origins are, like I said, they're varied. And he created himself before creating the universe and placing him on a level with, say, Atum, A-T-U-M, and Ra. And so for those of you who don't know Atum, that name actually is the name A-D-A-M. That's what people think that they're hearing. So, you know, Atum, like Adam and Eve, but nonetheless, there was an Egyptian god named Atum, A-T-U-M. And Ra, of course, you know, we know him as being the sun god. And basically what they're saying is that Thoth came to being sitting on a lotus flower in a primordial waters and in abyss form. He laid an egg that subsequently became all the matter in the universe. In other stories, he was brought into life by the speech of Ra. Okay, that's interesting. It's almost kind of like, you know, how they always depicted like Wonder Woman and how she, you know, came to life in a weird way. Now, in other stories, he was born from the skull of Seth or by an unnamed creator god during a moment of grief. Now, these stories were different based on region, time. Obviously, there's a lot of other factors that, you know, play into these particular stories, or narratives, rather, I should say. Now, there's one theory that Thoth began not only as the moon god, but as a funerary god. This would put him on the par with Osiris, Anubis, and Mahat. And his place of origin was either upper or central Egypt, depending on which way you want to go with that one. Thoth was considered to be a scribe and messenger of the gods. Now, for a lot of people don't know this, a lot of gods had what they refer to as scribes. And for that matter, a lot of kings and, you know, courts and things like that had scribes. Basically, a scribe was somebody that would dictate the story, write the stories of things that were going on around them and everything. And they had to have somebody to document it. So it's kind of like the best way to describe it is whenever you got somebody that takes wonderful dictation for offices. Same idea, really. Mind you, the offices are dealing with things like finances, and maybe to some degree, some of the scribes had to deal with finances as well. Now, that being said, Thoth was also an astronomer, a mathematician, scientist, architect, and expert in both human as well as divine laws. This guy had it all. I mean, he was like a smorgasbord of everything. And in his capacity of one of the most learned gods, he was also the god of knowledge, magic, and alchemy. me in particular is fascinating. There's a book called The Alchemist. For those of you who have not read it, I highly recommend it. Now, the term alchemy basically is based on the supposed transformation of matter. It was a concern in particular with attempts to convert base metals into gold or to find a universal elixir. Now, mind you, The Alchemist is not necessarily about that. It is, however, showing that this kid basically that he went and, looking for treasure, and he would go every place in the world to look for treasure, and he finally found this mirror that gave showed his reflection at the end of the book. Not to give it away, it shows his reflection basically saying that we are the treasure. We should treasure ourselves. And so I think that's a wonderful analogy for alchemy, to say the least, is that we should treasure ourselves. Said, his foremost attribute was as a lunar god. And I believe his name, really, the definition of his name, rather, really meant he who balances. Now, as the moon, he balanced the night against the day. The sun with the moon, and as a result, he is often depicted with a lunar disc on his head. The idea of balance is also deeply rooted in his role in the afterlife. And his daughter, hopefully I'm pronouncing her name right, I hate mispronouncing people's names, especially butchering them to where it doesn't sound right, Seshet, worked with Mahat, using the divine scales to judge the souls of the dead. As the moon god, he was also in charge of keeping time and making or marking the change in the seasons. And so obviously seasonal change, things like that, that actually was a big deal back then as well. And all of the calendars that we are noted for using, especially like here in the United States, we're learning more and more that the calendars and the way that we've told time and things like that are all coming into question, because we've been handed and indoctrinated to thinking this is how you tell time, this is how many months are in a year, etc. When in fact, it's a different ballpark. We're discovering, well, wait a minute here. We may not exactly have it correct, because especially with the fact that we're finding everything that we've been told, depicted, and handed down for a really long time is based upon lie after lie after lie. And it's very, very disconcerting, to say the least, and annoying. Now, Thoth was also given other epithets, including Lord of Time and Accountant of the Years. Wonderful titles, by the way. As the moon god, he would have marked the months which were measured by changes to the moon. Okay, well, that makes sense. This is what I said before. He was also a god of many names, including Estun, Hab, Kiante, Mihe, and Sheps. As a figure in the sky, he was referred to as the bull among the stars. Well, that one just doesn't roll off the tongue very well, but nonetheless. Now, he was most commonly viewed as a man with the head of a green abyss, and he held a was staff in one hand and an anak in the other, and he had the moon disc on his head. And in other depictions, he was portrayed completely as an abyss. This was most often used whenever he was portrayed as the creator god. Okay, so, like I said, every variation, region, time period, what have you, they're going to portray him differently. And for all I know, maybe they're all correct, depending on the time. And Thoth was often portrayed as a baboon named Ani. Sometimes the baboon would have a dog's head or face. Now think about this. I mean, I've always thought it was weird, even as a kid, whenever you would look at the Sphinx, Sphinx over in Egypt, how they would have like a human's face but a lion's body. I always thought that was really strange. This form was used when he recorded the results of a heart as it was measured in the afterlife. And in these depictions, he's often showing holding a pen and papyrus or stylus and slate. And so, in other words, he was always depicted as like writing something down. That goes back to him being a scribe. And he'd often happen to have the moon disc on his head in this depiction as well. Okay, so this kind of goes back. So that right there is starting to be kind of consistent. And Thoth has had close association with four major gods. All right, so remember we talked about Ra earlier. Association with Ra. Ra was considered the father of Thoth in many of the stories. and Thoth was spoken into form by Ra, and this is why Thoth was sometimes given the moniker God without a mother. Thoth was often depicted standing on one side of Ra's solar barak, and he was sometimes called the heart and tongue of Ra. It was claimed he invented speech. And if that's the case, I mean, it's kind of going, I mean, it's almost kind of like, you know, like Ra, you know, wouldn't be able to speak to, say, people, but he had Thoth to do it and everything, just because Thoth was actually able to, you know, kind of articulate himself a little bit more effectively or something. I don't know. Thoth was often considered the husband of Mahat, the goddess of balance and order. She was the other figure standing next to Ra's solar barak. And in the afterlife, she would measure the dead person's heart against that of a feather, and Thoth, ascribed to the gods, would record the results. Okay, so this is really interesting. How do you measure a dead person's soul against a feather? That's interesting. While very little is known of this goddess, her name, and it's called Nemiwal, she also embraces one in need. She is her Polytheist tradition. She is considered the wife of Thoth, and she was a regional deity who was worshipped primarily within the central part of Egypt. Now, Seshet was the child of Mahat and Thoth, and like her father, she was the goddess of writing, astrology, architecture, and all things that involve measuring. She was present with Thoth, Anubis, and Mahat when the human heart was measured in the afterlife, and together Seshat and Thoth were held especially sacred by many of the scribes. So in other words, Thoth was kind of like the blueprint of many of the scribes. They probably all looked at him like, okay, this is how I'm supposed to perform my task or my duty and how I'm supposed to behave, etc. Now, in one of the stories, Thoth was said to have retrieved the Eye of Ra. Now, when the Eye was away and carrying out vengeance on behalf of its master, Ra relied that he was vulnerable and needed it back. He sent Thoth to find out and where it was and return it. And this also corresponds to a story in which Thoth restores the Eye of Horus, who lost it in a fight. Now, Thoth was able to turn Horus' eye into an amulet, and the damaged eye came to represent the moon's phases. Wow, that's interesting, because, you know, like I said, we're still kind of learning how much we've been lied to, and a great example is if the moon is in fact real or not. And there's a considerable amount of debate, and I'm not going to tell you that it's real or not real. My thing is, I want people, whenever they're listening to my podcast, to make their own decisions. I'm not going to tell anybody what to think or how to think. That's just, you know, that's not why I'm here, and that's not what I'm going to do. In the many disagreements between Seth and the family Osiris, Thoth stood as mediator and judge. When Seth accused Osiris of not speaking the truth, it was Thoth who defended him, making the tribunal decision of whether or not Osiris spoke the truth, and Seth was the liar. Thoth defended Horus in a similar fashion, and Seth was again defeated. As the time counterpart of Ra, Thoth rode a silver barak through the sky as it carried the moon disk at night. Because of the close linking months with the lunar cycle, Thoth was known to be the keeper of any kind of time for the gods, and was often depicted with a palm frond from the with the notches in its making time. So, wow. Alright, so here's the thing. We know a lot of the gods were worshipped, and, you know, the idea of a single god came out way, way later. It was a long time after this. Thoth's central place of worship was Herpolytus, where he was venerated as the creator god, as a, you know, the one that puts everything together. See, it's kind of leaning almost towards that single idea of God, if you think about it, in a strange way. I mean, mind you, this is way before any of this. A priesthood was in place there for him, and a group of gods under his command. This group called the, hopefully I'm getting this correct, Ogdoad, were eight minor deities directly related to Thoth's creation of the world. And Thoth, outside Egypt, he became closely associated with the Greek god Hermes due to their shared attributes and activities. When Greek and Egyptian thought merged, the Thoth-Hermes hybrid was referred to as a, hopefully I'm pronouncing this correctly, Hermes Trismegistus, or Hermes thrice great. Interesting. So it's almost like they kind of combined the two in a lot of ways. Now, with Thoth being an incredible, important deity to the Egyptians, obviously, and he was representative of many facets of what people consider to be reality, you know, moon science, wisdom, etc., magic, medicine, you name it. He was, I mean, he had his hand in it. I mean, it's crazy. Now, as Ra's most trusted advisor, Thoth was tasked with recording all that happened, and just an incorruptible bureaucracy. He was viewed as a judge without any kind of equal. So his level of, I guess you could say, I don't say superiority, I think that's a terrible word, but just his, you know, level of consideration is up there. And more than a mere observer, Thoth was the enforcer of Mahat, or cosmic order. And in this role, Thoth served as both consummate diplomat and merciless executioner. So, I mean, it's, oh boy. Though Thoth appeared as both ibis-headed man and a baboon in Egyptian mythology, or as I said before, I hate the term mythology and legend, so we're just going to say stories, his personality remained consistent across these representations. And his imagery of being a baboon predated his ibis head portrayals, and the latter emerged as a primary depiction over time. So I've always been very curious about whenever we look at these things. And so if you don't know what an ibis, you know, head is, it's almost like a dog's head, and it looks like a wolf over a human. You know, we've all seen that. Both of those representatives had alluded to his status as a lunar deity, and curved beak resembles a crescent moon, and a baboon's head, it often topped with a headdress depicting a full crescent moon. So either way, he's associated with a crescent moon, so if that helps you any. Talking about Egyptian Egyptian stories, and I don't like to say the word mythology, but you know, the stories of who the Egyptians really were, or just the records, or whatever you want to call it. The reality was that each major city, and this is very interesting to me, had its own interpretations. And so depending on which city you're living in was the interpretation that you were handed to of who Thoth is or was. Herbolytus, for instance, the center of Thoth's cult, had never been the political cult of Memphis. Yes, there was a Memphis, Heliopolis, or Thebes, or so. Thoth existed alongside the divine families rather than being incorporated nearly into the divine bloodlines. Thoth's parentage, we already talked about, like, you know, the fact that he's got, you know, like some people that he's related to and things of that nature. Several particular stories regarding his parents, and due to the style of worship found in Egypt, they all contradict one another in a lot of ways. One was from Hippolytus, held that Thoth had no parents and was actually self-created. Okay, so that was the one we were discussing earlier. Now, in a parallel mythology, Thoth had ties to both Horus and Set. Now, that's an interesting one. I like that. Thoth has been created by Ra, Atum, and Khepriu as one declared, "I am Thoth, the eldest son of Ra, whom Atum and had fashioned and created by Kirippi." It almost, I don't want to say this, it almost sounds like he was like a hybrid of some sort, doesn't it? I mean, just when you start like listening to the language of this, depending on which story, Thoth was believed to have a number of different wives, and we've already gone through the names of them and everything, and so obviously he might have had more than one wife. There's always that. And children, like I said, his daughter name was Sechet. What's interesting is while Thoth was a tremendously important deity throughout Egypt, he held particular significance in Herpolytus, which served as his center of worship. So it's almost like, Okay, here you are. You're hearing that he's a scribe and he's working, he does some stuff for Ra, but then he's got his own group of people that worship him as well in his own city. So it's kind of interesting the way you start to kind of really kind of piece that together and everything. For those living in Hippolytus, the pre-creation universal existed in the form of Nun, an infinite body of inert water. And Nun in UN, by the way, I know it sounds similar to like a nun for the Catholic priest, but nonetheless, no pun intended, was a difficult concept to fathom. So the Hippolytans divided Nun into eight components, half male, half female. These eight deities were represented by frogs for the men and snakes for the women, and it included Nun and Nalut, the boundless waters, and Hun and Holint. Infinity. So, as I said before, I apologize in advance if I'm butchering the names of anything because I'm not trying to. Now, even outside of Hippolytus, Thoth had played an important role in the creation of the cosmos, and this is kind of a really big deal because, I mean, does this predate the idea of the Big Bang? I mean, I know that a lot of people who are Christian, particularly, they hold on to the Big Bang like it's the real deal and everything else, and I'm not saying that it's not, but what I am saying, there's a lot of things that have been like misplaced, taken, and just twisted and whatever. And organized religion's wonderful for that because they're trying to like set a narrative. Okay, so these nine gods are Ra, Shu, Tefnut, Geb, Nut, Osiris, Set, Isis, and Nephthys. These nine gods were not formed all at once. However, that being said, if not for Thoth's intervention, the list would have been cut way short. Huh. Ra created two children, Shu and Tefnut, who in turn bore the deities Geb and Nut. Ra wanted to claim his granddaughter Nut for himself and grew jealous when he saw Geb and Nut lying together in a fit of horrible rage. He placed a curse on her such that she would not be able to bear children in any month of the year. Wow. Thoth, whose existence at this particular point was unexplained, had a plan to help Nut get around that particular curse. He had been playing drouse with the moon, and as the god of wisdom, he found himself winning more often than not winning. And he proposed a wager. If he won, then the moon would have to give Thoth a position of her illumination, or a portion of her illumination. The moon accepted the bet. No one said the moon was good at gambling. It's interesting. Ultimately, gave Thoth 1/70 of her illumination. Thoth decided to add her winnings to Teleri, which is basically like 5 additional days of light to the end of 360 degree days on the Egyptian calendar. 360, not 365. Notice this. Because these final 5 days refer to as epagenimal days existed outside of the standard calendar, and Ra's curse did not necessarily apply to them. So now, free from Ra's curse, Nut was able to give birth at last. So that's a really interesting story, to say the least. The Egyptians regarded eyes as deities into themselves, likely because the word for eye sounded like the Egyptians' word for doing or acting, because Eret was feminine, not even masculine gods' eyes were regarded as goddesses. Wow, that's crazy, right? I mean, who would have known, Particularly nasty argument. Tefnut decided enough was enough and departed from the land of Nubia, or what people now know as Liberia, depending on which one we want to go with, filled with rage from this particular, argument. And she basically went through the countryside as a fire-breathing lioness. So this is interesting. Remember, I was talking about, the Egyptian Sphinx and how it always had like a human head, and I'm kind of been wondering if that was like simply just replaced, or if it was knocked off, or it's something weird, depending on the version of the myth, or as I said, the version of the story. Ra either wished to have her return so he could use her newfound aggression against his enemies. And he realized he had been relying on her for protection, and her absence made him vulnerable. In any case, despite Ra sent Thoth to retrieve her, Thoth tracked her down in an effort to get close to her without being even recognized, transformed himself into a dog-faced baboon. Despite his disguise, Tefnut identified the god of wisdom for who he was and prepared to attack him. Obviously thinking on his feet, Thoth quickly told the goddess that fate punishes every crime. This gave Tefnut pause, which in turn provided Thoth the opportunity to begin persuading the upset goddess to come back with him. Very interesting. I mean, this sounds like something out of, I don't want to say this, it sounds like something out of a comic book, but it's an interesting, you know, story to read, to say the least. And he told her tales of Egypt's beauty and well as an animal-based fables, extolling the virtues of strong allying themselves with the weak and the value of peace. One version of the story says that Thoth had asked Tefnut 1,077 times, okay, before she finally said yes. Eventually, Thoth convinced the volatile goddess to return with him to Egypt. On their journey home, they were met with a great fanfare and celebration in each town they passed through. By the time they reached Memphis, Tefnut's anger had fully subsided. So that's good, right? But this particular story, allegorical story rather, referred to the domestic effort of civilization and traced Tefnut's transformation into a model citizen. When the pair finally got back, Ra hosted a great festival in Tefnut's honor and congratulated Thoth for his excellent work. In some another version of the story, Thoth was rewarded with the goddess Nehemwata as his bride, and precise nature remains unclear. She may have been a manifestation of Tefnut, transformed by civilization as she left the desert, or an independent goddess unrelated to preceding events. Thoth had only a few days or few stories directly related to him, and he appeared in nearly all major Egyptian stories as an advisor or as a scribe. Most predominantly, Ra appointed him his advisor after deciding that handling the daily affairs on Earth had become far, far too much for him. Now, to facilitate his newly found responsibilities, Ra gave Thoth the Ibis to use as his personal messenger, power over the sun and the moon and apes that he could use against his enemies. Beyond his role in advising, Ra, according to many stories, featured Thoth offering the insightful advice that the other gods usually had the withal to take. Now, in the course of Osiris's reign, Thoth served as his advisor when Osiris embarked on his tour of the region and left Isis in charge. Thoth had stayed behind to advise her as well. It's interesting. After Isis gave birth to a horse, Thoth advised her to go into hiding till the boy was old enough to challenge Set. Wow. In one instance, Set claimed that he had intercourse with Horus, jeopardizing the latter's claim to the throne. Using his magic, Thoth called forth the, if you'll pardon the expression, the semen of both Horus and Set to see who was telling the truth. And unbeknownst to Set, Isis had figured out his play. During the night, she had sprinkled Horus's into Set's lettuce and ensured that Set's semen had been washed into the Nile. On Thoth's command, Set dutifully emerged with the swamps while Horus's semen emerged from Set's ears. Ew. Now, this particular case was thus decided in Horace's favor. In one final twist, the semen from emerged from Set's ear formed a solar disc that Thoth's proceeded to wear as a crown. What? I mean, it's crazy when you start really kind of like looking at these stories, and it's, I don't want to say it's like Shakespeare, but I can kind of see where, if Shakespeare was reading this, I can kind of see where he might have derived some inspiration at times, you know? All right, here's a good one for you. Thoth as being a healer. Another of Thoth's recurring roles was that of a divine healer. Now, this is interesting because, you know, divine healing has been around for a really long time, and he was obviously capable of healing almost any ailment, even those that the power Isis could not manage. When Geb was just a prince, he became prone to acts of aggression that were against his father, Shu. In one particular act, he turned himself into a boar and ate the eye of Ra, the moon. What? The eye sickened Gabe, or Gab brother, terribly, which would cause blood to pour from forth from his skin. Well, that's horrific. While Thoth's services weren't necessary to heal Gab, the ibis-headed healer did not want to return to the eye to its rightful place. Huh. So Thoth was a huge part of the resurrection of Osiris. He assisted with the embalming processes and with resembling Osiris's dismemberment corpse. While he also did not perform the spell that resurrected Osiris, he did instruct Isis in the use of charms necessary for the process. So this goes into all the, you know, all the stuff we've always kind of wondered about, like with the Egyptians and everything else, and how does that affect, you know, what they're doing, what we've been told, and things of that nature. You know, how does that work? While Isis was on the run from Set, her son Horus fell terribly ill from a scorpion sting, and despite Isis' medical prowess, she was incapable of healing him. And her sadness, or perhaps Horus's serious injury, depending on which way we want to go with this, brought Ra's solar barak to a halt, prompting Thoth to visit and figure out what was wrong. Upon descending the nature of the problem, Thoth recited a lengthy spell, much to his Isis jargon, and restored Horus to a full health. This is interesting. I mean, now after a battle where Horus had taken Set captive, Isis felt bad for, you know, the imprisonment of, you know, his brother, and set him free. And furious at his mother's betrayal, Horus struck a really big blow, decapitating her instantly, which Thoth replaced her head with Hathor's horns and solar disc, thus allowing the goddess to once live again. It's fascinating. I mean, you know, like I said, they were, you know, in a lot of ways they were family, but it's like a very, I mean, let's face it, this kind of goes into the idea where no family is perfect, right? For the average Egyptian at the time, one of Thoth's most important roles was what he played after they died. The Egyptians, Egyptian afterlife was not guaranteed and required one to live in a certain manner, or I don't like to say the word righteously, but you get the idea, to in order to gain entry. This is starting to kind of sound really weirdly familiar to what a lot of people, you know, as far as like the one God idea and everything else, as far as, you know, living a right life in order to gain entrance into heaven. It's the same idea. Thoth would assess a person's worthiness by weighing their heart against the feather of Mahat. If you have lived, for instance, if you have lived in accordance to what they believe to be righteous, the scales would balance and allow entry into the afterlife. And if the scales did not balance, however, the unfortunate soul would be devoured by the Kermit beast, Nemit, and Ammit, by the way, and cease to exist. So, I mean, and interestingly enough, The Egyptians believed that the process could be cheated. Those buried with the correct amulets and spells could prevent their hearts from being from revealing this, their misdoings that they had committed during their life. And this belief often offered some explanation for the elaborate burial rituals of the Egyptian, in particular the Egyptian elites. Those who had the resources to guarantee entry into the afterlife used them. Okay, so obviously, however they whatever they consider to be a righteous life or whatever it was, we don't know that because, obviously we're in a different time period, and so we don't necessarily have an idea what they were, what they were considered to be righteous and everything. The ancient Egyptians are many times over remembered for their really big burial structures, hidden tombs, and mummifications. And that's what a lot of people, where their heads go. I still think that there's a lot, personally, I think there's a lot of unanswered questions. I mean, obviously, whenever you start to listen to these stories, and first and foremost, when you start to listen to the description of how they were, viewed and described and everything else, it does sound very, extraterrestrial based. At the same time, it does sound very, and I've said before, I don't like the word myth, but mythological. And, it sounds incredible. But I'm also thinking about this much. There are hieroglyphics of these things all over the place. And especially like in the Egyptian pyramids and everything else. And I'll be honest with you, I think it's, they wrote what they, what was there. They depicted what they saw. And as weird as that sounds to a lot of people, it's not just the Egyptians, obviously. It's the Native Americans have got some interesting stuff with cave paintings and things like that. I think that, life is so mysterious and vast that we think we have a handle on things. We think of an idea of what reality is, or at least constitutes reality. And then you read these things and you look at this stuff, and it's almost like the idea of what we consider to be reality doesn't really hold water, Animal sacrifices were not uniformly popular throughout Egyptian history, and seems to have increased during times of political strife. And the practice peaked during the third intermediate period following the collapse of the New Kingdom, and this is in 1075 BCE. And through this particular period, saw a very huge increase of succession of rulers. Life for the common person went on with little disruption. Point of fact, most people may not have had more disposable income due to the reduction in taxes being sent to a central government and authority. And so if you think about it, it's always about the money, or it's always about what they can control. This kind of goes back to like, what are the elites been trying to do for all these years, all these centuries? It's the same thing all over again. Now, the pharaoh was more than just a political ruler at the time. However, it was also the center of what was considered to be the ancient Egyptian religion. With no consistent religious leadership, personal piety gained significance. Wealthy Egyptians could afford to give bronze offerings, while less well-off worshippers offer embalmed animal sacrifices. So this is kind of going into, them giving, like, say, the a goat or whatever it was, just to see what would be sacrificed. Now, across Egypt, there were at least 31 animal necrophiles containing at least 20 million embalmed animals, and estimated 6 million of these animals were ibises, the ones I was telling you about, where it looks like looks like kind of a bird wolf thing or something. The thoat could take the form of an ibis, and the birds also served as personal messengers. It is believed that these particular sacrifices were dedicated to the abyss headed deity, so that would actually kind of weirdly make sense if he actually did kind of look like that. Though some of his sacrificed birds were wrapped with written petitions, and most were not wrapped that way. And obviously there's a suggestion that praise or requested many have spoken to the creatures before they were sacrificed. So that gets weird, man. It is not particularly clear what the majority of these petitions were about, as the god of wisdom, science, medicine, and judgment, however, Thoth would have been able to offer a wide range of blessings depending on the situation. While some scholars really kind of believe that the sacrifices on the scale required industrial farming practices, more recent evidence has come about that suggests these birds were actually a wild fowl captured solely for sacrifice. In either case, the Egyptian fervor for sacrifice was hugely lucrative business. Priests were looked at as being unscrupulous at the time. Vendors would at times sell fake mummies, often contaminating just a shard of bones from the alleged animal. Records from the Temple of Thoth at Saqqara included corruption charges laid against the priesthood in relation to counterfeit mummies. Wow. Such records often indicate written on an ashraka or pot shards. Interesting. Indicated that the six priests were imprisoned for their crimes and reforms were implemented to prevent any future fraud. Wow. It's interesting. All the different roles that we hear that Thoth actually possibly had, or, you know, depending on which narrative we're going to go with, he seemed to be a very deeply important person as far as in the Egyptian culture, and just understanding the different variations of the possibilities of deities and things of that nature. And his role as being a mediator, bringing balance and harmony to otherwise a treacherous situation, can actually be applied to polarized world that we're living in presently. You know, but we have been living in a polarized world, and I think it's since the eclipse and the emergence of the new earth, I think we're going to see less and less divide, less and less, you know, polarization, less and less duality, really. And we're understanding the you know, synchronicities of what the duality was, which is spirituality and, you know, the connection of to the creator and to source, or organized religion, which essentially separates you from that and, you know, takes it from you and, you know, tells you that you're born of sin and all sorts of other factors. And, you know, as I said before, early in this particular podcast, that all these religions, it's like they take and pick from one another. And, you know, it doesn't matter what culture, what society structure we're talking about. If you really start to listen to what they're saying, you know, listen to the stories, the narratives, and everything else, and it's mind-boggling almost, you know, when you step back from it. You know, don't put your own religious spin or personal spin or ego spin or whatever you want to call it. Because there's, let's face it, there's a lot of egoism in what people think they understand, you know, they think they know about religion. And to be able to have a conversation with somebody, you know, an intellectual one, where you're essentially, you know, questioning things and, you know, trying to put things into perspective and things like that. It's a very, some people get really, how should I put this, deeply vile about it. And that's putting it lightly, where it's like, you're not supposed to question this. Like, well, that right there should be a red flag, shouldn't it? You know, because it should be all about, how else are you supposed to understand something deeply, unless you question it, unless you ponder it, unless you really, you know, dig deep and do the research, whether it's, you know, with the Akashic records, or whether it's, you know, in a book, or whether it's online, or what have you. And I think this is a great example of this, where we're not totally sure of, you know, Thoth as far as how he came to be in existence. You know, how was he created? How was, you know, he born? You know, what have you. I mean, it's a mystery, much like life. But his role is, like I said, as a mediator, bringing balance and everything. understanding the finding a middle ground, and that's kind of an important thing to be, able to be deeply diplomatic and really just kind of like stepping back from something and not being married to it and being flexible and, trying to take it all in and everything. And, especially, like I said, it does at times feel like I'm pointing the finger at, Christianity at times. It's more like the idea of organized religion as a whole, because what I see with organized religion is that it takes people away from spirituality and away from the creator, and it takes them and just manipulates them, and doesn't even talk about the fact that, hey, our pineal gland has been calcified by taking too many pharmaceuticals. And then they wonder why people are disconnected from, spirituality in a lot of ways, or why they're in a certain mindset or something to that effect. In order to look at like those life as being like, say, a positive thing, drawing from these ancient, narratives, it became obviously very evident that while times have changed from a fundamental challenge in the quest of humanity remained, though it was considered to be like the vast realms of what was to be influential, but it serves as a beacon guide towards what wisdom and balance and a deeper understanding of life may be. I'm not saying that, hey, I'm a big Thoth fan or something like that. That's not what I'm saying. I think it's, if we're looking at this particular narrative and everything, and mind you, there are other narratives out there about Thoth that may not be nearly as flattering. Whenever you're looking at this stuff, whether it's, dealing with Egyptian gods or, for that matter, Greek gods or whatever, the one thing I can honestly say is, they're dealing with multiple gods, not just simply one singular one. And it's interesting how Thoth gets almost like the title of the creator god, and it's really fascinating because a lot of what the language was, it was very. It was in a lot of ways leaning towards the notion of a single, God entity and everything. I thought that was really interesting with the language and everything. Obviously the question, of course, is, people have always been asking this, and I've always found it, I used to find it enthralling whenever I was younger. Now I find it almost kind of like a, are we talking about this again? You know what I mean? Like, people are always like, well, who has it right? Does this society have it right? Does this one have it right? What if they're all right in one form or another? I mean, the idea of religion in general seems to be, a divide and conquer tactic in a lot of ways. And what if these stories that we're reading about Thoth and about Ra and all that, obviously for that time period, they were true. What if it's all about what time period you're living in, whether or not that is true or not? I mean, like I said, right now, we're learning about how much we've been manipulated and lied to. And right now, anything quite literally is up for grabs. I mean, whether it's religion or whether it's mathematics, whether it's physics, whether it's this or that. I told you guys before that whenever I was younger, I had like 113 average in, US history, and then I realized that most of what was in the history book was completely incorrect, which was kind of frustrating. It kind of took out the flair of me having 113 average in history. I could just simply, memorize all the stuff that was in the book, but did I know how accurate it was? No. I mean, this is back before the days where we could really look up stuff, and as far as the public libraries wouldn't have it because they would have the same exact stuff that was in my textbook, and obviously online whenever I was younger, that wasn't really so much an option. Nowadays we have, thankfully, we have the internet, we have people that are really learning about stuff and really diving deep and telling you what they've found and or what they haven't found, as the case may be. And as a society, like I said, we're learning, we're gaining momentum, we're gaining speed about learning what we've been lied to about. is, because, I mean, think about it, for the longest time, we were told that, humans built the pyramids, that, I mean, maybe they did, but everybody's like, of course, the question is, for what purpose did they build them, originally speaking?
The interesting is that whenever we're looking up this stuff, and obviously whenever we do it, we're trying to gain a better sense of ourselves, not just in today's world, but just in general, and seeing through all the myths and seeing through all the lies and being able to understand that human existence is much more intricately detailed than what we've been led to believe, initially speaking. I know that the Vatican holds a lot of secrets and has for a really long time, whether it's technologies or whether it's information about dates, times, you name it. And I've always found it really, kind of curious at best, because obviously they're trying to control a narrative and everything about how people see themselves or how we see history and or whose history are we talking about. And this is a great example of this, about was he exactly how he appears as far as how he's being described to look, or what was the actual relationship and everything else. And it's like I said, it's very, very Shakespearean in a lot of ways, and I just find it fascinating, because obviously when we're looking at history, when we're looking at this stuff, it's going to tell us 1,000 times more about ourselves, 1,000 times more about society and how things run or have been run and whatever for a really, really long time. It can tell us so much about ourselves and where we're going, where we're headed, and the technologies and just the language and the culture and everything else, and how does that fit into our society today and things like that. And so whenever we're looking at something, whether it's Atlantis, whether it's this, whether it's Telos, whatever it is, it's going to tell us another part of our puzzle that we're still trying to learn. And I think, let's face it, I mean, if you think about it, human society is at times fixated upon learning a lot of things from the past, understand the present, but if we can learn the present, understand the past as well, and how it all connects to each other, and how what we've been told, and what we've, when what's real and what's not, and how does this work, and just looking at all this stuff, I mean, it's like you lay it out and you're like, oh my gosh. And the technologies, I mean, it's crazy. I mean, I read a book years ago about how the ancient Egyptians invented everything from the socket wrench to the septic tank. I thought it was fascinating. And I think it was by Richard Hatchard Childers, I believe it was. And anyways, it was just really interesting, especially like for somebody like myself, I was that generation that grew up on, Raiders of the Lost Ark and everything else, and the idea of like looking into things and, really getting, diving deep into everything. And that's kind of pretty much what I try to do on my podcast, is like to look at everything, because nothing at this point, surprises me, if that makes any sense. And I know it's a hard thing to say, because some people really get totally surprised by stuff. Things don't surprise me like they used to, and I don't think that's like me getting older, becoming cynical or something to that effect. I think it's just that I've learned so much to where, at times I can start to see how the puzzle pieces start to fit, and then at the same time it's like the chair gets pulled out from underneath you. So it's a little bit like that at the same time, if you can imagine that is. That's kind of where I think we are in a lot of ways. With the new earth and everything coming up, I think more and more truths are going to come out, and things that have been kept hidden from us for a long time, and they've been hidden from us for a reason, is in order to control us and manipulate us and everything else into a certain ideology and mindset and what have you. And now it's like everything's changing. I mean, it's so interesting how that works, right?
And, you know, he was dealing with, like, things like the months. I mean, did you hear that whole part about the 360 days of the year type of thing? And the calendars and the times and everything else and the seasons? And, I mean, it was like, God, this guy was into everything. It was unreal. Anyways, thank you guys for tuning in again for another episode of Revealing the Truth of Branwells. Please tell your friends I'm on Amazon, iHeartRadio, and Spotify. And I'm on Instagram, TikTok, although lately I'm kind of annoyed with TikTok at times. And then I'm also on Twitter, though I'm still trying to learn how to navigate Twitter a little bit. Anyways, thank you so much for tuning in. It is both an honor and a privilege to be able to do these podcasts for you. Thank you so much.